We've just spent a lot of time talking about how to plan ahead for the end of your life and maybe help your relatives and loved ones plan for the end of their life. Now we're going to bring in a doctor to share some experience and more information about something called palliative care. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Dr. Toby Campbell, is a UW Health Chief of Palliative Care, holds the Ellen and Peter O. Johnson Chair of Palliative Care, served as the Hospice and Palliative Medicine Program Director from 2010 to 2017, and his research interests are in high-risk shared decision-making, communication, education, and empathy. So as we visit with Dr. Toby Campbell, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Do you have palliative care? And maybe you don't, or maybe you have questions about how it works. Do you have a personal experience with using palliative care? Love to hear from you, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Toby Campbell, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Larry.
So first, maybe for those who aren't completely familiar with it, what is palliative care?
Yeah, let me answer that a couple of different ways. I think of us as the specialists who try to help patients and families who are dealing with some kind of serious health issue. So if you're facing something serious, odds are palliative care might be something to provide an extra layer of support, provide help with tough decisions, provide help with tricky symptoms that are hard to manage. Or just as Katie Butler was saying, how can we make sure that the healthcare system is working as well for you as it can? And oftentimes that means asking subtly different questions. Like sometimes people say, what can I do about my, you know, heart failure or kidney disease or whatever? But we try to ask the question, what should we be doing? And that means we're customizing the healthcare system to fit that individual person. And that takes into account, as she was saying, for example, I don't want to be admitted to the hospital. You know, period.
Yeah.
How do we make the healthcare system work the best for each person is really, I think, the role of palliative care.
And it's quite different from hospice in many ways, although hospice may kind of help a little bit in that area.
I think great point. I think hospice is a provider of palliative care specifically for people who are nearing the end of their life and who meet the hospice entry criteria, which are generally speaking, specifically willing to forego life prolonging treatments and be in the final 6 months of life. It's primarily provided at home as opposed to palliative care, which is often provided in the hospital or in the clinic setting. I would say that palliative care and hospice get along really well with each other, but we do serve patients at slightly different points in their life and as they deal with their illness, where palliative care is a little earlier and hospice a little more towards the end of life.
So the person who uses palliative care is someone who is on the path to death, maybe in a year or more, or...
You know, that could be, although sometimes, Larry, I'm working with people who are receiving curative intent treatments. Take, for example, somebody who's getting a bone marrow transplant where they are facing something very serious that might well take their life, but maybe the bone marrow transplant works and they're cured. But they still have lots of serious issues to think about, lots of symptoms to manage, lots of big decisions to make. And so it's not required, I guess, in the same way that hospice is, where you're supposed to say this person has 6 months or less to live. Palliative care, we are interested in supporting people facing something serious. And oftentimes that means they're on the path towards the end of life, but not necessarily.
Okay, so if someone chooses to use palliative care, how do they... Do they wind up with different doctors and staff who work in that field then? Or
it's really important to us that we work with your existing docs, nursing support teams that are currently taking care of you. So we very much are an add-on, not really a replacement. We try to integrate ourselves within the system that's currently taking care of you.
And are you then someone who fights for the patient then with that? Or a fight may be the wrong term.
Well, I think it's a fine term. I think of fighting for me as a form of advocacy. I think we are there to advocate for what we understand from that particular individual about what's best for them. That might be saying, gosh, you know, they're really into, their goals are really well aligned with having that surgery or being admitted to the hospital or getting that chemotherapy drug. Or equally, maybe we learn that their goals are not consistent with being hospitalized or getting another round of chemotherapy. And we try to help translate between the maybe more traditional healthcare system, who, as Katie Butler said, tends to be organized around prolonging life as the prime objective, where we might come to that system and say, hey, you know, for Sally or for, you know, this particular person, here's what they hold most important. Here's what's most valuable to them. And so what we're hearing is this. And so we may modify or negotiate the individual treatment goals based on that.
I'm just to bring up our current situation, it may be, you know, typically doctors many doctors don't spend a lot of time with the patient or knowing the patient. And that may be even more apparent in this life that we're living now in COVID-19 times, where they're just the medical profession is just slammed.
Yeah.
And which would make, I would think, make palliative care people even more important.
I agree completely. We are at UW Health, but I can speak, you know, more generally because our palliative care community is well connected. We're not that large of a field, and so we tend to know each other regardless of where you practice in the United States. And our community is really stepping up strongly to try and respond to the needs of individual patients and families wherever you happen to be getting sick. And so now just speaking here locally, what we are putting together, Larry, is ways in which we would be able to speak to families who may well not be able to visit, as you all were talking about in the last session, with their loved ones, even if that means that they're nearing the end of their life, given the severe restrictions for safety reasons on visitation. But we don't want families to be cut off. So we're trying to figure out how can we effectively communicate with families in a regular way so that everyone is informed and connected as best we can. And I think this is an important role for palliative care. I think of us as the kind of the people who show up when you're facing a crummy situation. And try to, you know, do the best we can to make that situation better. And, I mean, that's exactly what COVID-19 and this pandemic presents us with.
Yeah, it's, are you making progress in that? Not for curing COVID-19, but just in terms of figuring out how to work with the families better?
Well, we have been working at using telehealth, primarily video conferencing consultation, for a couple of years now. I think our field thinks that this is probably something that, you know, depending upon the circumstance, we can do. We like, our preference is to meet with people face-to-face. What we have found is that if you meet with someone face-to-face and establish a relationship, you can oftentimes continue that reasonably well over a telehealth screen. It's a little better than a phone, although the phone works too. And so we're trying to extend that now. We might not have, in this current pandemic crisis, we might not have the opportunity to meet with people face-to-face for that initial encounter and develop a relationship and some rapport. But maybe we can do that over the screen. To be honest, we are racing to kind of develop implementation plans for how we might operationalize doing this more broadly as we expect to begin to see cases soon.
Yeah. Our guest today, Dr. Toby Campbell, UW Health Chief of Palliative Care, and holds the Ellen and Peter O. Johnson Chair in Palliative Care. And he is with us to talk about care, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your experiences with palliative care. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back. So you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Congress remains deadlocked on a roughly $2 trillion coronavirus relief package. NPR's Susan Davis reports lawmakers are on Capitol Hill at this hour trying to iron out their differences on some of the key aspects of the legislation.
There is broad consensus on some of the main pillars of that legislation: loans to small businesses, loan guarantees to small businesses, and loan forgiveness to small businesses if they keep their workers on the payroll. Direct cash payments to individuals and families that could total up to $3,000 for a family of four.
NPR's Susan Davis reporting. The Senate is revisiting the stimulus package today after meetings last night failed to produce an agreement. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised to vote this morning, but Minority Leader Chuck Schumer objected to an early vote and called for the Senate to meet today at noon. The coronavirus continues to spread in Europe, with more than 2,000 deaths in Spain and cases still rising in Italy, the UK, and France. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports French citizens are heading into their second straight week of home confinement.
French celebrities are sharing their thoughts for coping online, and musicians are live streaming their practice sessions. But police have handed out more than 80,000 fines to people venturing outside for unessential errands. The government has had to close all parks, beaches, and riverbanks to walkers and joggers, and many cities have imposed a nightly curfew. President Emmanuel Macron is looking at toughening restrictions and not even allowing people out to exercise. The €135 fine for unessential errands may be increased to €1,500 for repeat offenders. The lockdown is likely to be extended beyond the end of March as the death toll in France continues to climb. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The International Olympic Committee is facing mounting pressure to postpone the Summer Games in Japan amid the global spread of coronavirus. NPR's Tom Goldman reports Canada has announced that its athletes will not take part in the games.
Canadian officials say they've made the difficult decision not to send their athletes to Tokyo for the Olympics and Paralympics this summer. This is not solely about athlete health, their statement says. It's about public health. Canada's dramatic action follows the International Olympic Committee's first public acknowledgement that it's considering postponing the games and that it'll decide within the next 4 weeks.
NPR's Tom Goldman reporting. Separately, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says the Olympics may need to be delayed. There are more than 1,100 diagnosed coronavirus cases in Japan. Stocks are trading mixed at this hour on Wall Street. The Dow Jones is down 287 points, the S&P down 33, the Nasdaq up 21. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 12:04. I'm Hannah Haynes. Governor Tony Evers announced this morning he would issue a so-called stay-at-home order tomorrow in an effort to slow the spread of the new coronavirus. Evers announced the move on his official Twitter account. He said he would announce further details tomorrow. Evers had said as recently as Friday that he thought the state could avoid the kind of shelter-in-place order being handed down by governors in other states, including Illinois. Republican legislative leaders praised that stance, saying they believed the further shutdown of businesses was unnecessary. But today, Evers said it was clear that more needed to be done. While the extent of the order was not immediately clear, Evers did signal that it could go beyond business closures and limit people's interactions in their personal lives. Evers made the announcement as confirmed cases of COVID-19 continued to climb in Wisconsin. As of yesterday, the State Department of Health Services listed 381 confirmed cases of the disease in Wisconsin, including four deaths. A second State Department of Corrections employee has tested positive for COVID-19. That's according to a press release. The second case is an employee at the Columbia Correctional Institution. Both employees are currently quarantining per Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. The release says, quote, "At this time, no individuals in our care have tested positive, and our healthcare professionals are monitoring all individuals in our care closely." You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can find more of our reporting on COVID-19 on our website, wpr.org/COVID.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And Americans for the Arts.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Associated House Rights, Explore Lacrosse, and Madison Symphony Orchestra. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Details at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Ganschert Nursery and Landscapes, with full-service landscape design and installation to Madison and surrounding communities since 1951, including low-voltage lighting and mosquito repellent systems. Ganschert.com.
Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about palliative care right now with Dr. Toby Campbell. He's a UW Health Chief of Palliative Care, holds the Ellen and Peter O. Johnson Chair in Palliative Care. And we want to hear from you as we go along today. What questions do you have about end-of-life health care? What do you know about planning for your own late-life health care? Just give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Dr. Campbell, a number of people on board with questions. I think all good ones here. Let's go to the phones. Patty and Toma, you're up first. Thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Patty. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't have a question. I just have a comment. My father is 96 and a half years old, and we have palliative care for him. And it is one of the best things that we have done. They treat him like a human being. He's very cognizant, so he has no memory failure at all. It's just health issues. And they always talk directly to him, and they're a great go-between with the medical staff for us. And they've made suggestions and recommendations that we would never have thought of for him.
Oh.
So it is the best thing that we have done for him at this point. He's in assisted living, and they visit him there. And we always know when they are there, and they just keep us very informed.
Patty, thank you so much. Dr. Campbell, a comment.
It sounds like it's working like it should. Patty, I'm so glad that the palliative care team is there to help you, your family, and your father. You know, that's really, Larry, the point I was trying to make, and Patty illustrates it, that we are an add-on. We try to serve as a go-between, make helpful suggestions. We try to be helpful, and I'm glad that your team is helpful for you guys.
Yeah, for sure. Can you think of one thing that that you hadn't thought of that the palliative care people had thought of, Patty?
Gosh.
I put you right on the spot. I'm sorry. maybe I'll turn it back to Dr. Campbell. That was kind of unfair to spring that on her. What are a couple of things that people typically don't think about?
You know, some of them, I think, Larry, are more fundamental. A couple of my favorite questions to ask people once we've established the seriousness of whatever it is, the health condition that we're talking about, is to say, when you think about the future, what do you find yourself hoping for? And then I turn that coin over and ask, when you think about the future, what do you find yourself worrying about? And oftentimes in the answers are some really important facets of life that matter a great deal, or worries and fears that we might. So I like to know, what am I aiming for and what am I trying to avoid? And the suggestions just kind of emerge from those places, you know?
I gotcha. Well, Patty, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's give Lisa in Green Bay a chance to join in. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to clarify something for people who don't know. Hospice doesn't kick people off after 6 months. I'm a hospice nurse. And the key phrase that we use is that if the disease takes its normal course, the loved one could be taken from us in 6 months or less. But not all disease processes take the normal course. So I just wanted to throw that in there. So thank you.
Lisa, thank you very much. Dr. Campbell, any comment there?
Well, just I agree. Lisa's correct. Hospice, there's this sort of regulatory framework with which they have to work inside of, and I suppose all of us have to apply the regulatory framework as well. But certainly, you know, life is gray, right? And so even the hospice Medicare benefit and the hospice benefit in general exists within that gray. So you have to draw black lines, and there's this 6 month thing, but there's plenty of room for hospice agencies and doctors to work in the best interest of patients. So she's right.
Let's take another call. Lori in Beaver Dam, it's your turn now. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you. I recently retired from 25 years of working as a hospice palliative care nurse, which I truly love the profession. I wish you could speak to the frustration or the issues that in regulatory and reimbursement that prohibit people from receiving palliative care. If they haven't been hospitalized, they won't receive a palliative care consult, and they need them ongoing to help them bridge between deciding whether they're going to go with a recovery situation or an end-of-life care. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, so Lori raises, I think, a really interesting point, which is that most palliative care programs in the country exist in a hospital, and they're a primarily hospital or entirely hospital-based service. The movement, though, in palliative care is all towards how do we do just what Lori is suggesting, meet patients' needs when they are not in the hospital. That would allow us to connect with patients and families earlier in the course of a disease, and it allows us more time to have these important conversations and to come up with those, you know, little nuggets and little suggestions that the earlier caller was talking about, Larry. So we have a better chance to influence the care when we meet people a little earlier and in the outpatient setting. And really, Lori, the barriers, I'm not sure they're regulatory so much as just manpower and having someone at an individual clinic system or hospital system there who knows how to build a new program. We have pretty robust outpatient programs here at UW Health. There are many places across the country and across Wisconsin that do as well. But it does take a fair amount of effort to build new programs and get those programs running. We know, Larry, from the science is pretty clear here when palliative care is involved in that outpatient setting and earlier rather than later, i.e. in the hospital,
yeah.
We see a lot bigger impacts in terms of people actually live longer. They appear to live a few months longer with similar diseases. So, for example, if you have advanced lung cancer and you get your palliative care early rather than late or never, you seem to live a few months longer. And so we get some of those really bigger impacts when we meet people earlier.
I wonder if it's just the personal, I'm thinking about this. If you're sick and you've got somebody who, as one of our earlier callers said, looks at you, treats you as a human being and with respect, if that doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, you're asking a great question, actually, and our whole field is trying to answer your question. So that is what is the analogy is often made to a medication. So if there were a medication that helped cancer patients live 2 or 3 months longer, that would receive rapid FDA approval. So palliative care is doing that. What's in the vial, so to speak? What are we doing that's making that big difference? And it seems as though, Larry, some important things are, yes, about good care, but let's be honest, oncologists and cardiologists and pulmonologists, they're providing good care too. So it's also that it's more, I suppose, because to your point earlier, doctors often don't have a lot of time to spend with you. So if we're spending, you know, some extra precious minutes and making sure that the care you receive is well aligned with who you are and your values and goals, that probably matters. We spend a lot of time talking about coping. How do you understand your illness and then how do you cope with it? How do you keep living life in the face of this serious illness? And I think many of us are coming to think that that may be the biggest place where these big impacts, like living longer, show up.
Interesting. Dan in Maquanigo has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Greetings. I have a concern regarding palliative care and the desires of the patient. I think we as patients need to be very careful and understand what criteria the hospital has in terms of care and treatment. Excuse me. Sometimes especially the religious hospitals do not always coincide with what we want in terms of medical aid in dying or rather palliative care.
So it's a question of almost like choosing a facility for palliative care in a way.
Yeah, and I had a little hard time understanding.
He was talking about sometimes a hospital, if you're a hospital in your area happens to be a religious-based hospital for some reason, that they may have their own thoughts about care versus someone who does not hold that same religious denomination, okay. For example.
I don't work in a religious-based hospital system, so I am not the most familiar with decisions that might be different. Although in my experience, for example, just working in town, there's a Catholic health system called St. Mary's. And so in my experience, collaborating with my colleagues who work at St. Mary's, I haven't really noticed any substantial differences. Regardless of where you work, it's the right thing to do to listen to someone, understand their values and goals, and make well-aligned treatment recommendations. And I think that holds true in all of the health systems that I'm familiar with. I think your point, Dan, that we need to listen carefully and respond accordingly, I think we would all agree with that for sure.
And I had a call from Bill in Barnes, Wisconsin, couldn't hang on. He says he has a friend. So this is a very specific question. He has a friend in hospice who's probably going to pass on in the next several days. And he's wondering who he should call once that person dies. Does he call an undertaker, a sheriff, or somebody else? He's really wondering about he is the living person who will be sort of responsible.
It sounds like your loved one is on hospice, and so then you just call hospice. The laws and rules and regulations that we were talking about earlier are different for people who are on hospice, and those apply all the way up until death and even past death. And so the hospice team is very experienced with dealing with those issues. It's a little trickier when someone's not on hospice, actually, because then you have to engage kind of emergency services, even though it's not an emergency. And there are, just some additional, I think, questions that sometimes get asked that are presumably easy to answer. But when someone's on hospice, it signifies to the whole system that the expected outcome here is that that person will die. And so the system flexes towards understanding that, medications are easier to acquire with less regulatory hurdles. Equipment is easier to acquire with less regulatory hurdles. After someone dies, it's easier to take care of them and their remains and remove them from the house appropriately and safely. And all those things get a lot easier just because I think the whole system recognizes, this is what's supposed to happen.
You can join in, too, with your questions, comments, or experiences with our guest, Dr. Toby Campbell, as we talk with him about palliative care, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we got an email from Deborah She wants to know how someone with a severe case of coronavirus or COVID-19 doesn't want to go to the hospital. Can they be able to access palliative care at home? She lives, she's in a rural area in northern Wisconsin. She also wants to know where she can find more information about palliative care.
Great question, Deborah. I think, let me take it a couple of different ways. If people with chronic illness that are currently at home do not have COVID-19, but worry that if they were to get COVID-19, that that would cost them their life, I think that is a very real concern, and I share that concern. Our team, and I know palliative care teams across the country, are rapidly trying to figure out how can we hear people and help them make plans just in case something terrible like that happens to them. How can we make sure that they are well cared for, that they get the best care possible, even if that means quickly triggering hospice, for example, and providing end-of-life care at home or in an appropriate facility. There's some question around safety of taking care of people with COVID-19, for example, by family members at home and hospice. And so I think there's a little bit of discussion in my field around how we can most safely and effectively care for dying people with COVID-19. But obviously the vital factor being understanding that person's, that individual person's values and goals, and making sure that we can get the best care possible to them, wherever that might be. So I think Deborah, could make clear to your decision makers, your chosen family, your friends, whoever that happens to be, how you feel about if you were happen to get COVID-19, if that means that you would want to engage with a hospice agency and receive great care, but end of life care and not go to the hospital. I don't know anything about your health circumstances, but I would assume that that would be a reasonable thing to do and that everyone would support you in your network. But it's important to let them know how you feel about that.
Barbara in Madison has something for us. Let's go to Barbara. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I had hospice in-home services in another state 20 years ago. And in a 2-year period of time, I used hospice services for my mother, my mother-in-law, and my husband. It was a godsend. And I was so frustrated in the years since then when people whose loved ones were dying would refuse hospice services because that means I'm accepting the fact that he's dying. And we need to educate people that this is a kind, compassionate thing to do for these people that are dying. We have to accept that death is a reality.
Yeah. Thank you, Barbara, very much for calling. Dr. Campbell?
Thank you, Barbara. Wow, what a trauma. Three people you love in 2 years. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Let's remind everyone that life is about living. And whether you are someone who is in the final weeks or months of life, or whether you are someone who is feeling well in the prime of their life, life is about living. And what a hospice agency is trying to do, what a palliative care team is trying to do, what a cardiologist is trying to do is help you live well. Now, when you are nearing the end of your life or you have more serious illness, your palliative care team and your hospice team are taking into account your serious illness, but they're whole objective is still about trying to help you live as well as you can with whatever it is that you're dealing with. When it gets to be time that time is growing short, now maybe there's hours or days or let's say just a few short days or weeks left, now maybe more of the intent and more of the thrust of the healthcare you're receiving is about dying well. But gosh, for us as a hospice and palliative care provider, taking care to help someone live as well as they can is really what it's about. Now, we're not dismissing or, in fact, we're incorporating the serious illness into our care plan, and we're acknowledging that life is limited, but it's really about life. That's much more fun for us, and yeah. I think you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can second Barbara's comment about hospice care. My mother went through it, and the people who worked with her, I actually consider almost like saints. I mean, they were wonderful, wonderful people, and made not only my mother's life better to the end, but also the family.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that too, Larry. And that reminds me to just make one point. It's important not to push people who are not ready for hospice in particular, because it has these regulatory frameworks around it. Because the experience, if you're ready for living as well as you can with whatever time is left, and if you're ready to be peaceful and comfortable at the end of your life, whenever that comes to pass, then hospice is going to go great, and you're going to have a wonderful experience, and you're going to find them to be saint-like, just as you described, Larry. When people aren't quite ready for that and feel as though they should go back to the hospital when there's some setback or other, and then sometimes hospice will be seen as a barrier to that, and they'll have negative feelings about hospice. Even though hospice is doing what hospice does, and the palliative care providers are doing what they do, regardless, so that the kind of perspective and the goals that one has are really important. So that's one of the important things that my palliative care team does, particularly in the hospital, but in the clinic as well, is helping make sure that we're getting the right care to the right people at the right time. And so that might be hospice, and that might not be hospice at that moment in time. But getting care well aligned to values and goals is key.
Just to go back to Deborah for a minute, the email that we talked about a few minutes ago, one part of it I'm not sure we answered. She wanted to know where to go for more information.
Yeah. I think the palliative care is a local service, and so if you are, you know, wherever you are, I think the most direct source is to talk to your doctor and your clinical team. Hey, is palliative care right for me? Where could I gain access to palliative care? So regardless of where you are in Wisconsin or around the region or around the country, frankly, I think that's the most direct place to go. There are other good resources if you're looking to read things online. I think for the Center for the Advancement of Palliative Care is perhaps a great place to start.
I think so. And again, the goal for palliative care, in the last 30 seconds.
The goal for palliative care is to help people live well with serious illness, help them connect with their doctors in a way that's meaningful, help them connect with their families in a way that's meaningful, to help make sure that when faced with a crummy situation, you get the most out of the healthcare system that you can.
Dr. Campbell, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. Will you come back and be with us again?
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, Larry.
Love to have you. Dr. Toby Campbell, UW Health Chief of Palliative Care, holds the Ellen and Peter O. Johnson Chair of Palliative Care. Great to have him with us. And great to have you listening in today. I think we had a wonderful show today, as I hope we always do. And I hope you will stay with us through the afternoon. There's lots more in store. And, of course, we'll be back tomorrow to talk about more things that you, I hope, will find interesting. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.